All right, so this is our last one for the time being. And I obviously picked this theme to coincide with it being this time of year. Obviously, it's difficult to know quite what you know and what questions you have, but if we just work through a few things and bear in mind that as we do that, there should be something that you can benefit from this. There are very broad range of views about Christmas, and there's a very extreme range of views about it. That's one of the puzzles as to why that's the case. And some people get very emotional about it one way or the other. What you do about this festival that's now become so entrenched within our particular society. I'm not trying to do an attack or a defense of anything. I'm just trying to find some information, maybe some guidelines, maybe some principles, and see what you want to decide from there. I know some people think that Noel is sort of Hebrew for no God, but that's not an accurate translation. And I know some people think that Santa is an anagram of Satan. Well, it might be, but that doesn't seem to solve anything either. So we're going to avoid certain bizarre things like that. And if we get rid of a little bit of confusion and ambiguity, then that's as good as anything. I want to read something to start with, which I've adapted slightly from something that I found rather intriguing. In thousands of churches, schools, and playgroups, hard-hearted innkeepers turn away cherubic Marys and their usually embarrassed boy husbands. Surprisingly clean shepherds tend flocks of cotton wool sheep. Angelic choirs sing, and a pink plastic baby Jesus is carefully laid in a manger of yellow straw amidst remarkably well-behaved animals in a clean stable. This event has become a foundation of our particular way of celebrating Christmas. But the real story is harsher. It's even more dangerous. It begins with shame and scandal and ends with a massacre. Not much cause for celebration there, you might think. In fact, the version I like is where the innkeeper is played by a little boy who's rather miffed that he wasn't invited to be an angel or a shepherd. So when the knock comes on the door, he opens it and says, in response to the question, "Is there any room?" "Oh yes, there's plenty. Do come in," which rather changes the narrative somewhat. Particularly when he adds that everyone else has gone away for Christmas, so there's plenty of room. So the first thing is, why is there an innkeeper in our nativity stories when there isn't an inn? Why are there other things in the story that is told at this time when it's not actually in the Bible? And the Bible is remarkably brief and sparse. I'm sure you're aware it's only in two Gospels. So, if you want to actually remind yourself what is really there, you'll need to turn to Luke 2, for instance, and also in Matthew as well. Now, I've already said, sort of giving a bit of a game away, the reason there's no innkeeper might seem surprising, but we're going to find out why there's no innkeeper because there isn't an inn. The common story that's often told, I've got occasional PowerPoints to put up. See if I can find one that's the right one at this point. Can you see that now? Someone will have to talk to me. Can you see that? Have I shared it?
I can't see it.
Okay, thank you. Let me try again. Is this going to be better?
That's
Yes.
gonna come.
That's
Yeah,
fine.
you're on the way.
I thought there was something wrong because I couldn't see you. You'd all disappeared. So, what's the common story that's usually told? You've got Mary, Joseph, and a donkey traveling to Bethlehem. And They arrive just about in time for the birth. She actually gives birth the night she arrives. They can't find a room in the local hostelry, so they have to use a stable and a manger. So why are we telling a story that's not really in the Bible? And there is a reason. And the whole, what we might call the late arrival, imminent birth story, was actually written as a piece of fiction, basically. I mean, it might not be intended to be like that, but it certainly is fictional. Around about 200 years after the events. And there's a strange document called the Protoevangelium of James. Now, if you can work out what that word means, proto usually means early or first. An evangelium might make you think about a gospel story. James is absolutely no James that we know of at all. They wrote these things under assumed names. And he wrote up a very strange version of what was the story, full of imaginative details and full of factual errors. So he actually wrote it up as though Mary was so heavily pregnant, she was desperate to get there that night so that she could give birth. And then it all happened in the way that the nativity story actually expresses. This is the sort of thing that you find in this document. Mary saying something to Joseph along these lines. Take me down from the asp, for the child within me presses me to come forth. And actually, in his version, Joseph responds by taking her into a cave just outside Bethlehem. And then has to rush off and find someone to help in Bethlehem. And along the way, there's all sorts of fanciful visions and things happen. And when he returns with someone to help, the baby has already been born. And then, mysteriously out of nowhere, a woman called Salome appears and is told that a virgin has given birth and that she's still a virgin. Salome actually doesn't believe that, so her hand turns leprous. Meanwhile, poor old Mary has to undergo an examination to be found that she still is a virgin. But to help the matters along, an angel appears and tells Salome that if she will touch the newborn child, then her hand will be healed and her leprosy will go. And that's apparently what happened. Now, if you just from those few sentences and little snippets from that, you realize what that was really like. It should make you realize that some of the other things that are included in it that we have incorporated into our Christmas version, our nativity version of the whole thing, is open to suspicion as well. So if we don't read in the Bible about a donkey or an inn or a cave, or even that the birth happened the night that they appeared, we're quite right to question where all this has actually come from. Now, when the actual this Protoevangelium was put out there, it was contested very strongly by certain people at the time, people like Jerome and so on. So in some ways, it wasn't as though everybody thought, oh yes, this must be what happened. But what did happen is that certain elements of it got transferred into the telling of the Christmas story not all the leprosy stuff, not all the Salome stuff and so on, but the idea that she was heavily pregnant, she was riding on a donkey, they needed to get there and so on. And it was just transferred not to being just outside Bethlehem, but to just inside when she arrives. So let's have a little look at Luke 2 and verses 1 to 7. I think that particular PowerPoint is finished now, so I'll get rid of that and we're back to normal. So if you look at chapter 2 and verses 1 to 7, what do you notice about it that actually confounds the whole idea of the late arrival, imminent birth? Which verse?
Verse 6.
While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, which obviously means that they've been there some time, but while they were there, the actual time for the birth took place. But they've been there some time. We don't know how long, but this was no rush job. Why should it be? They knew full well that they had to go to Bethlehem. Why would they leave it in such a haphazard sort of way? It almost gives the impression that Joseph was either not very competent or not very caring if he didn't make proper arrangements. So they'd been there some time before the actual birth took place, not on the night of the arrival. That's the first thing. Now there is a reference to a manger, but there's no mention of a stable, and there's no mention of an innkeeper. That's, I think we've got to have Matthew in front of us as well, just to get the whole picture. Now, why on earth do we think that there would be an inn in a place like Bethlehem? What kind of inn would it have been anyway?
In verse 7, it says in my Bible, because there was no room or public or place for them in the inn.
Yeah, so we're going to find out what that really means then. Okay?
It's also in the Greek interlinear.
Okay. But let me explain a little bit more about what that means. For a start, the word room doesn't refer to a room as in a room in a house or a room in a hotel or something. It means space. Like there's no room on the table for another book because the whole place is cluttered. So it's not about a room. All the rooms are full, no vacancies. It just means there was no space in this particular place where they had arrived. So where had they actually arrived at then? What was actually happening? Well, they were going to their hometown, weren't they?
Yeah.
They were going back to where they were well known. They were the line of David. They were going back to where their family was. And if there's one thing that would definitely happen in Middle Eastern culture and hospitality, is that arrangements would be made well in advance for people travelling of that kind. Let me try and bring up another PowerPoint. It might be this one, I think. So I've already mentioned that the word room is not a room with walls. It's room topos, as in space or place. So something was full, but it's not like something being fully booked out.
We don't have the PowerPoint, Paul.
Sorry, I've done the same thing again. Thank you. I seem to be forgetting to do the share bit because I'm going in and out on this. Let's is that come up?
It's coming, yes, it's on its way.
Can you see it now?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so as I was saying, we've firstly got to understand what the word room means, as in no space or place. Now, just a little diversion, but it isn't really. Have a look in Luke 10, verses 34 to 35. Luke 10, verses 34 to 35 is another very common part of the gospel story. What is the story about?
Good Samaritan.
Yeah, and within the story of the Good Samaritan, there is, of course, an inn. The Good Samaritan takes this guy to an inn, and here he does give coins to an innkeeper. So this was actually a commercial inn. This was a place where people, for money, hired a place to stay. This was a commercial inn. And there's the Greek word that you find in Luke 10. And if you know anything about Greek, you'll recognize the first bit means all, and the second bit is to do with receiving. So this kind of guest house, should we call it, was a place where all could be received. In Luke, though, there's a different word being used. It's not a commercial inn, it's a katalima, which is actually a very general sort of word, as a place of shelter, place to stay, and also particularly used now for just a guest room or part of a house where you could put someone up. Now, I'll show you some pictures of this in a minute, because if you haven't seen this, then it will help. But Luke has deliberately used the right word, although he hasn't used the word for the commercial inn. He's used the same word in Greek as you'll find in Luke 22:11. What's happening in Luke 22:11? Luke 22:11, anyone found it?
Passover meal.
Right. And the idea is that they would go and find a room to have the meal, which would be an upper room or a guest room, special room, within a private home. So that's the same room as Luke 2, the same place, same idea, as opposed to Luke 10, which is a proper inn. So the inn of Luke 10 was on the journey between the two places. Which is where you would have such a thing. But in a small place like Bethlehem, you didn't have hotels or travel lodges or whatever you want to think of them as. You just had places where people lived. But as part of the places where they lived, they would have guest chambers for when people came. And the literal translation, which actually is now in some Bibles, it's certainly in a literal translation. So we got rid of the idea of room in an inn. There was not a place, or I might want to say there was no space for them in the guest chamber. In other words, it was already full to such an extent it would not be an appropriate place to give birth. when it was already had lots of people there. Has anyone got a translation that actually uses that phrase, those words, rather than the traditional, there was no room in the inn? Is that a no? I know everyone's got their microphones off, but it sounds a bit silent to me.
Sorry, Paul, we're all looking up and unmuting. It all takes a while.
Okay, I'll try and go slowly then.
In the New Man Bible, it says place, so in.
I think we've got that. Going to say it again, please?
In the New Man Bible, it says place, but for them, but it still says in.
Okay.
The Amplified Bible says there was no private room for them at the inn.
Yeah, certainly the idea of privacy is part of this. It still seems to be insisting upon translating it as an inn, though. Which, if Luke had intended it to be that kind of inn, he would have used the same word as he does in the parable, and not the word that he used for the Passover meal.
In the Amplified in 22:11, it says, "A teacher asks you, where is the guest room?"
The guest room, yeah.
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 22:11 seems to be consistently translated guest room, but it's chapter 2, verse 7 that is... seems to be rarely translated like that. It's interesting.
Yes, but it's the same Greek word, isn't it?
Yes.
Because we've got fixated with the idea that this was an inn, because either that's what our experience suggested, but in a little place like Bethlehem, people did not go and stay in a little place like Bethlehem. You didn't turn up, you didn't sort of look on TripAdvisor to see which was the best place to stay in Bethlehem. It was very, very small. There'd only be private houses. But private houses were built with guest chambers so that when people came, there was somewhere to stay. And as I said, I will show you pictures of this in a minute when I get round to flipping the thing over.
Oh, yeah? We've probably got the idea of an inn because it's in the King James Version.
And?
Well, that's the one we were brought up with.
Okay, yeah.
Complete Jewish says there was no space for them in the living quarters.
Okay, yeah, that's a much better thing. In other words, they turned up at a home, a family home, of some of their relatives.
Yeah.
And if you know anything about Middle Eastern hospitality, nobody, particularly a pregnant woman, would be turned away and told to go into a stable. That just would not happen. And the other thing is, as we've seen, this wasn't a last-minute thing where they turned up looking for accommodation. That makes it look as though Joseph was very sort of inept at trying to work out what to do and where to go. They travelled in advance. They found somewhere to stay with relatives, but when the time for the birth arrived, the place where that would normally happen, i.e. this private room, was already full because there were other people that were there. So the giving birth bit was awkward. Now, maybe other people moved out so that she could give birth in privacy in that room, but it would not be appropriate then to have the young baby in a very crowded room with other people there, assuming that's what it means, there was no space there, and so on. So what about this manger? Where would the manger be? Well, a manger was part of a house in a little place like Bethlehem. And this is now where, if this actually works, we might get some pictures. Ah, good, excellent. That's a plan. Now, everybody in a place like Bethlehem had their own small patch of land and their own few animals that they looked after. And during the daytime, the animals were outside, but at night time, they were brought inside. And they were therefore brought into a part of the house, which, for want of a better word, would be called stable. They were brought in for obvious reasons, one, so that they weren't stolen, but also so that they were kept warm. And in fact, the animals themselves helped keep the place warm during the night, you know, because there was no central heating. So their body heat contributed towards the warmth of the place. I'm not saying that was a great idea, but it probably might have been necessary. And the next picture will show you what that looks like from the side. So in other words, this place for the animals was part of the house, but it was down some steps from the main living area. So if I go back there, you can sort of try and match the two up, I hope. And you can see that those mangers, as we're calling them, which is basically the feeding troughs for the animals, would be at the level of the head or mouth of the animals as they were down in the doorway. They'd gone through the door. Okay, so people could go down the steps to them, but otherwise they stayed there. But the mangers were at the right height for them to feed from. And then putting it all together, the house might, for most of them, just have enough extra room for there to be a guest room, a katalima. So that would be a typical village house of someone who was not that well off in a place like Bethlehem, where you could have guests to stay, but otherwise it was just a sort of one-room place, and the animals had to come in at night and share all that. Have you got the idea?
Yeah.
Paul, can I interject?
Yes, please do.
And this makes perfect sense to me. The fact that Bethlehem would have been teeming with people without accommodation, because they were coming back to their place of birth.
Yeah.
And therefore there was an undersupply of places to stay.
Well, indeed. And you'd try and find someone who had room. I'm suggesting that Joseph and Mary did find somewhere to stay, but when the time of the birth came, by then it was very crowded, and therefore extra provision had to be made, if you like, for this. But it begs another question, and that is, if they're from the line of David, I think someone's trying to calculate by then how many people there would be of the line of David who would all be flocking back to Bethlehem. Okay? Because, you know, the lineage would have spread out and there'd be tens of thousands of people, probably. So how did they all descend on this very small place? The chances are that the Romans, who were very efficient at this sort of thing, had worked out that the census didn't all happen on the same day. Okay, this is not like our census, where we have one day in which everyone has to fill it in. It would take place probably over several weeks. And so people, as long as they went during this particular time to this place, then it could happen. So yes, it would be crowded, but we don't have to have the ridiculous situation of tens of thousands of people all descending upon just a couple of hundred houses or something. I could spend time giving you more examples of how this sort of house is mentioned in the Bible, but it fits throughout the Old Testament. If I can find them quickly, I will just read one or two out. There are plenty of examples in which there are animals either in the house or coming out of the house. Now, do you remember the strange story of in Judges of the guy Jephthah and his daughter? And the father made the vow that whoever comes out of the door of my house to meet me, I will sacrifice to the Lord as a burnt offering. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Right. And he says, whatever comes out of the door of my house. What he didn't expect was his daughter would. He expected that it would be an animal that would come out of the door of the house.
Yeah.
When Jesus talks about lighting a lamp and it gives light to all in the house, that implies there's only one real room where everybody normally stays, this family living room. There was only one main room in the house. The guest room, the had one, was tacked on at the side and so on. There's something else in Luke where an animal is untied and led out from inside the house. I'll try and find that one so you've got the context of that. Doesn't each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or donkey from the stall and lead it out to give it water? The stall would be this side bit that's part of the house there and so on. Now, this puts a slightly different edge on things, because actually it means that from Mary's point of view, this was a much more comfortable sort of experience, well, as comfortable as any birth can be under this sort of circumstances. But, you know, she wasn't in agony on the donkey, hoping to get there in time. She wasn't bundled into a cave. she wasn't even eventually in a smelly stable. She was quite well looked after. And although Jesus rather unusually had to be wrapped up and put to bed, as it sort of says, implication, put to bed in one of the mangers, we'll think about why that was in a minute, it's a lot more sort of sanitized than some of the versions that we have. And one of the problems that's built up around this sort of story is that we like almost, from a, almost an over-spiritual sort of perspective, to try and make it as difficult and nasty and horrible as it could possibly be. As though somehow that sort of makes it a better story and makes it more sort of, oh, how wonderful that Jesus was born in this particular way. And I guess this is coming back to the heart of what this is really about. The most important thing, of course, about the whole Christmas thing is the incarnation. It's what actually happened for God to become man in the first place. And we don't need to over-dramatize it. We don't need to make it more sort of gory and awkward. We just need to fit it within a typical Middle Eastern, what would become eventually first century, sort of setting, a known setting. And this sort of understanding that I've been giving to you is found within books by people who understand the culture and nature of what it was like then, and not people who are trying to sort of produce a nice story later or today.
Paul?
Hello there.
I think that Joseph would have reckoned to get to Bethlehem and then back again to Nazareth in time for the birth, but the registration just took so long that they got delayed there, hence Jesus was born in Bethlehem.
It might be, but actually there's no indication of them even thinking of going back to Nazareth.
But why wouldn't they? That was their home.
True.
Where her parents were.
But they didn't, of course. If you think about it, they, after the birth, the next place we find them in is Jerusalem, 8 days later. And then they go to Egypt. They don't go back to Nazareth for a long, long time.
Sorry, was it to the synagogue for circumcision, and 40 days later to the temple, then back to the house, wherever that was, for the wise men to visit.
But they wouldn't have gone back and forth to Bethlehem again. It seems as though they stayed in that area for a while, and then they fled down to Egypt. There's no record of them going back to Nazareth in the meantime, I don't think.
No.
That's a different sort of... I haven't got my notes on that, but I did try and put that together. I don't think there's any problem with them going there for a while, because Joseph, if he needed to do some work, could do exactly what he was doing in Nazareth. He could have done that in Bethlehem or anywhere else. In fact, he often did most of his work not in Nazareth. They would travel to other places to do work.
I was thinking that they went to Bethlehem with the idea of get registered and go back home to Nazareth. But because registration took so long, Jesus was born in Bethlehem.
Yeah.
Was circumcised while they were there and named. And then they were still in Bethlehem area at 40 days when they had to go to Jerusalem for purification. And then they went back to Bethlehem for the wise men to visit and be told by the angels to clear off to Egypt. So they didn't have to go from Nazareth past Jerusalem to get to Egypt, where Herod would have nobbled them.
Yeah, okay.
you can gather we've looked at this a bit.
Yeah.
We thought, obviously, the wise men had to come after they'd been to the temple, because at the temple they could only give two doves, so they were still poor.
Yeah, fair enough. And when it says the wise men came to a house, we don't now have to think, oh, which is this particular house? It would be one of these houses again. But we know they came quite a bit later, or we assume that they did, because Herod then was assuming that the baby could be at least 2 years old and so on.
Or up to two, wasn't it?
Well, up to 2 years old. So he may have been sort of overemphasizing it a bit.
Well, it could be from when the wise men first saw the star and started looking into the history of it.
Indeed, yes. There was the length of journey. And, of course, it was the shepherds that immediately saw what was going on. And coming back to the idea of the manger, that was the sign for them. That's very clear. That was the sign for them that they found the right house and the right baby, because there'd be no other baby that would be in a manger. So that was the point of the manger bit of it from their point of view. And it does fit with the idea that he was born in a simple family home, not in a palace, not in a wealthy mansion, not in any special place, but in a rather peasant home, and was greeted by lowly shepherds and all that sort of thing. So it does fit the sort of humbling aspect of understanding that God was born into this world, very lowly and so on, but not necessarily a dirty, squalid sort of stable.
Paul?
So, yes, someone else?
Yeah, I just wondered about this idea of the baby being in the manger being the distinctive thing. Presumably, after the census had finished, if they were staying in the house for a long time, they would have been moved into the Cataluma.
Oh, eventually, yeah. It all depends how many people left and how long the whole thing took. What was this census really like? We don't know. Did Romans suddenly come around and knock on the door and say, right, who have we got here now, and tick them off a list or something? The whole process, I suppose historians have tried to go into this, but I haven't come across anything that says what was actually happening physically to do this registration, unless anybody else has got any ideas on that. But I suppose the point is, you don't set off on another long journey with a newborn baby, particularly as you've got to go through the various processes according to the scriptures, So, and with therefore they went to Jerusalem because it was nearby.
But I was just thinking that if that was the uniqueness of the identifying for the Magi, then that indicates that probably their visit was quite close.
Okay, let's just clarify something. The manger was for the shepherds.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Yeah.
Beg your pardon.
Yeah, the wise men were just looking for where the star eventually came. So.
Thank you. Yeah, I was getting myself in a muddle.
I thought you might be, but there we go. I think that's probably enough from that side of it. So from all that, you should have understood how our nativity story, as often played out, has extra elements that you don't find in the Bible because they've come from this other rather strange piece of writing that I said was largely rejected at the time, but some of the elements seem to have come across, whereas when you read the scriptures carefully, it wasn't a last-minute dash to get there in time, and then a sort of panic because she gave birth that very night. That puts a different perspective on it. Plus the fact that we can understand now why there's no innkeeper, because there wasn't a commercial inn of the kind you read in Luke 10, which you would go to if you were making a journey between places and you wanted to stop off as part of that journey. But once you get to a place, as far as I'm aware, once you get to a place, they just didn't have commercial inns within the centre of these little places and so on. Okay.
Another bit of the nativity scene that we can debunk is that the shepherds brought a lamb.
Yes, go on.
Well, they weren't theirs to give to anybody.
Oh, okay. Yes, because?
Well, they looked after them for the temple.
Exactly.
In so, Rome.
Yes.
And if they'd brought a lamb, then they'd have taken the lamb to the temple on the 40 days.
Yeah. And
they didn't.
Yes. So, yes, if there's lots of little... Well, so what would there be in this stable? There might well be some animals around, but they'd be the sort of animals that a typical peasant family might have. But the shepherds certainly didn't need to bring anything and so on.
Okay, people, I'm going to leave you. Thank you very much. See you on Tuesday.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. The next thing we can poke around in is the interesting fact of the date of this. It wasn't at all settled upon December the 25th for quite some time. The first recorded mention of December the 25th is AD 336. Before then, someone had concluded it was May the 20th. Another significant option was March the 25th, the spring equinox. And there's also the idea that the Messiah must have been born on the same date as he actually died. So again, part of the spring time, because apparently all great men are born and die on the same date. That was a piece of sort of common mythology at the time. Proves you're a great man if you actually die on the same date that you were born on. But December the 25th wasn't established as any kind of date for thinking about the birth of Jesus until the year 336, and then under the influence of the church it became the key festival. Because, as you know, in some places they still celebrate it on January the 6th. And some churches, particularly out in the East, even after the Western Church has said in the 4th century, it's December the 25th, some of them still said, no, it's the 6th of January, and held out for centuries after that.
Was there not also a date in September, Nisan?
Not that I'm aware that the church fathers or anybody actually came up with. I think that now is a more recent understanding of the best possible time of year when this could well have happened, fitting all the actual data a lot better. So, but I don't find any early reference in some of the first, second, or third century to people suggesting then that it was that. They tended to go for something more in the spring.
Well, after all, isn't it the conception that's the miracle?
Absolutely.
So if that's December, delivery would be September.
Indeed. Absolutely.
The birth could not have been during the winter time because the sheep would not have been on the hills.
Exactly, yeah. There's lots of good reasons like that why the December date for the birth doesn't fit, things like that. It's also assumed that the Romans would not have organised for a census to happen at that time of year where everybody would be on the move during the winter months. Assuming that they were caring enough to take this into consideration. Now, another aspect of this is why bother at all? What's so important about the birth of Jesus? You've just already said the crucial thing is the incarnation. And I think it's right and proper that at some point we stop and think about that crucial aspect of God becoming man, because without that, nothing else really follows. But why does that mean we have to celebrate the birthday, particularly when you don't know when it is? There's so many things about it that have not been looked at properly. Jesus wasn't in the slightest bit bothered about the date of the birth. And in fact, as someone pointed out, that Jews didn't celebrate birthdays anyway then, and celebrating birthdays generally was a pagan thing to do.
Correct.
And there's only three birthdays mentioned in the Bible, and they're all bad. All bad things happen on those particular occasions. And none of them by Jewish people as such. One is by Pharaoh. The one you're most familiar with is Herod, of course, which led to the death of John the Baptist. And the other slight hint that birthdays might have been considered a time to celebrate something is in the beginning of Job. You remember Job was rather concerned about his children having all sorts of wild parties. And there's a sort of hint, I don't think it's 100% certain from the translation, but they did this on their own day, which means the day that they regarded as their birthday or their name day or whatever. So, oh great, there's another birthday coming round, let's have another party. And that made Job think, oh, I better do a sacrifice for them in case they're sinning and so on. It wasn't until the end of the 4th century that someone decided that really we ought to celebrate this festival. But actually then there's been a sort of up and down history about this. You probably know that Christmas was, well, frowned upon and then eventually banned in England for a while at the time of the Puritans. They thought it was really not a good idea to celebrate it. But it did start to return to popularity again in about the 18th century. And one of the people that helped popularise it was Charles Dickens through his writings. And most of the Christmas celebrations that we know of today seem to have originated in later times. I know some of them might go back to earlier pagan things, but the whole idea of having a Christmas tree is relatively modern, and decorations and so on. But one of the reasons why it was decided that a festival of some kind was a good idea from the 4th century onwards was because this was the time of some of the greatest heresies, particularly about the nature of Jesus himself, his divinity. So it was decided that really, in order to combat this idea that Jesus was not fully divine, we ought to recognize at some point, and this therefore this date was chosen, and his birth was the moment in which that heresy would be most severely sort of dealt with. Though, as we said, it really is the incarnation, and so on. If you find that people try and tell you that Christmas trees are totally forbidden because they're pagan and people cut them down and adorn them when they shouldn't have done, particularly quoting somewhere in Jeremiah, he's not talking about Christmas trees. He's talking about trees that were used to form idols. So unless you are sort of worshipping your Christmas tree, you needn't worry about that. There's nothing in the Bible that says that the tree itself is wrong, unless it becomes a symbol of idolatry. Of course, Santa Claus is a different matter altogether. Anyone know where Santa Claus actually, I don't mean Lapland, that's not the question, where the idea of Santa Claus actually originated?
Isn't it St. Nicholas and something to do with Czechoslovakia or somewhere? Czechoslovakia.
It was Turkey.
Turkey is right, yeah. But do you know the story behind it?
The old man's neighbour had three daughters and he left pouches of money for them to have a dowry.
Yeah. There was someone... and yes, there was a poor man who had a large family, many daughters who couldn't afford dowries. So one night, this guy called Nikolaus took some gold pieces and smuggled them through a window into the poor man's house so he could get his daughters married. And hence the idea of a Santa Claus who brings stockings full of goodies at night through the chimney. That sort of legend actually began to develop. I haven't got a date here for that. That's annoying. And you know roughly when that was? The original St. Nicholas story? Sam, have you got a date for that?
No idea.
No, okay. Goes back some way anyway. But the more modern Santa Claus is developed a lot later. And I think it was Coca-Cola that insisted that he looked like that and was dressed in red. Became a more sort of commercial sort of thing. And Coca-Cola as a company decided that they really wanted to boost his image through them, so dressing him up like he did. So if we're going to think, I would say, more sensibly about all this, I remember that I was... in one of our church Christmas services, and someone that was doing it had a brilliant idea, and he said, I want to introduce you to my sons actually, because he's got more than one. I want you to meet them and I want you to get to know them. And he then took out a photo album of all the pictures that he could find of them as babies, and he said, here they are, come and get to know them. And the point was very quickly realised that actually you don't get to know someone's son by just having photographs of them as newborn babies in cots. So why do we think that people will come to know who Jesus is by going along to a nativity thing and seeing a plastic doll wrapped up and put into a stable or a manger. If we're going to get anything out of presenting Jesus at this time of year, you can start with him as a baby, but if you leave him there, if you leave at the end of the Christmas period or the whatever presentation you're putting on, if you leave him as a baby in a manger, you haven't really told people anything much about him. People don't feel threatened by that. You've got to say something about who this person turned out to be, how he grew up, what he did. You've got to talk about his death, obviously, if you're going to preach the gospel. And in fact, if there's one thing that you could bring in at this time of year, if churches are brave enough and people are clear enough in their teaching and preaching, as well as talking about this first arrival of Jesus to planet Earth, you could say, and he's coming back. And when he comes back, it won't be as a newborn baby. It won't be someone who you can wrap up and put in a manger and just sort of go all feel all fuzzy and warm about. He's coming back, and that's the Jesus you need to get to know, and leave people with that challenge. Because actually, I wonder how many people, lots of people go to church at Christmas time. It's one of those key times of year. But how many of them are really converted or challenged enough by whatever is done? So the question behind all this is, are we making enough out of what we do in order to present Jesus as he really is, not just as he might have been or as he was at the time? If you want someone to get to know your son, you've got to do more than just give them a photograph of what he was like as a newborn baby. You really do want them to meet him. So the question is, can we change Christmas for the better? What can we actually do, either individually or as good churches, good fellowships, to actually still do something, not throw it all away and say, oh, well, there's nothing in the Bible and Jesus wasn't bothered and we've got so many different things that are wrong about it and it's all very commercial. Somehow we've got to cut through all that. But what can we do to make it better? Any thoughts on that?
Silence seems to reign, Paul.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Does that mean people have not got any thoughts?
I thought you'd said it by saying within the service, remind people that Christ will return.
Well, okay, yes, in some ways I probably answered my own question before, and I was just wondering whether anybody got any experience of either a Christmas service or some kind of event put on that really made a bigger impact. I can remember something that we do. I think it's Graham Kendrick wrote a series of songs called Make Way for Christmas. And I think that told a bigger story than just the traditional nativity one. And we used to go and do it in the open air. So maybe there's something like that, but I still want to give you a chance to come up with some good ideas or some thoughts anyway.
I personally find the commercialization of Christmas an incredible negative, because it detracts from Yeshua coming to earth.
Yeah.
So how you get around that, I'm not sure.
This is part of the problem, that certainly that the world has claimed this in some way. And, you know, there's the old sort of phrase, how do you put Christ back into Christmas sort of thing, which, churches can still sort of try. But I think we're always going to find that this commercial, someone has said that the X in Xmas stands for exploitation. I think exploitation. I mean, it's a shame anyway that it's called Xmas instead of... But I'm still a bit puzzled by even the word Christmas, because it sounds like we're celebrating the birth of someone called Chris. And, you know, who is this Chris that's so important to us that we're celebrating his birth? Can we at least say Christmas? or call it something different with Jesus' name in it? instead of a word that sounds funny.
Well, sometimes when I'm writing it, I put Christ in capitals and Mass in small letters.
Oh, right. Yes.
To differentiate.
Yes.
One of those songs the leader of the singing group wanted us to sing, and I said, pardon? Was basically see Christ in all the tinsel and twinkles and all the fripperies that go with Christmas. And I thought,
yeah.
No. sort of making use of the decorations.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I heard of someone who, towards the end of a carol service, that the next carol was When I Survey.
Ah.
Oh.
Now that's the thing. As in all sorts of songs like this, it's well worthwhile just checking what the words of the carols actually say. Very nice sort of songs, but how much truth and reality is in them as well.
Most of them, oh dear.
I know.
Yeah, one year, I think it was the year before last, which... even on Christmas morning, the crib had been under the Christmas tree.
Right.
So I went and hoiked it out from there and put it central, and then sat or knelt looking into the crib.
Yeah.
As a form of worship. And everyone thought I was mad. I don't care. It brought the point. Another time, I went into the prayer room and got the cross and stood that on the corner of the crib.
Yeah. Yes. And there must be other Bible readings that you can add to the standard ones that again references back to this is why I was born, this is why I came, pointing ahead to his death and so on.
But one has to keep within the time limit.
Well, fair enough to that as well, but let's cut back on some of the things that
couldn't be there anyway.
They shouldn't be there anyway, yes.
Well, we're not very conventional in our fellowship, and we actually do very often take it right through to Christ's death and an altar call. Not every time.
Yeah.
34 years, so it's changed over the time. But it is the whole thing, you know.
Yeah. If people are only going to come to church once a year and that's it, they've got to hear everything as much as you can at that time. So on.
I don't know what our church would do with an altar call.
Don't do it anyway, any time, yeah.
Well, they say that if you want prayer, that the prayer team's available.
Yeah.
Well, nobody points people to us and we forget to put our badges on.
Here's a difficult question and thought to go with it is, I wonder what Jesus actually feels about Christmas now. He's alive. We could actually ask him. And I wonder what he would say. I wonder if church is actually prepared to ask Jesus how he wants them to celebrate this time. And what would they do if there was a deafening silence comes back? Oh, so you don't want us to celebrate it. What should we do instead then? Or, Lord, tell us what to do that would make you feel happy. Because like a lot of church-based things, it all seems to be about making us happy and have sort of warm, cosy feelings and so on. But what if the other side of that is that actually Jesus feels a bit left out, even a bit saddened by it all. And maybe for him, this is probably the worst time of year.
Yeah.
But I leave that as a thought rather than as a major preach.
Maybe he'd like us to celebrate the Feast of Hanukkah.
Well, maybe. And that's another interesting one, because like Purim, if you like, it wasn't one of the major
Correct.
Times, but it was something that came out of a tradition. I'd say, yes, you would want us to celebrate Passover and Tabernacles and recognize those. And yes, he would have celebrated Hanukkah and so on. For us, Hanukkah could just be another traditional thing, because it's actually based upon a Jewish event, which we can be very grateful for and recognize and understand what happened. But it doesn't, that necessarily isn't relevant to understanding the life of Jesus. It wasn't something that he fulfilled.
No, that's true.
Maybe we should go back to thinking about tabernacles, because isn't tabernacles the one that actually occurs at the time that we most likely think that Jesus was born? And wasn't it John that said, the Word became flesh and tabernacled amongst us?
Yes.
So his incarnation is, what a bit to actually teach people that the incarnation was literally his tabernacling, his taking on of a skin as a form of sort of temporary accommodation from that point of view, and try and link it in with tabernacles. Yeah. And you, have you probably heard the most convincing argument for Jesus being born around the Feast of Tabernacles?
Yes, I mean, God with us is the it appears to be the most compelling thought about tabernacling with us.
Well, you can actually work out, there are enough clues to work out when Jesus was actually born.
Yeah.
If you trace it back, and it, you, for this you need to think about someone else. You need to think about John the Baptist.
Yeah.
Now, Jesus and John the Baptist were born how far apart?
6 months.
6 months between them. So if you know when John the Baptist was born, you can work out when Jesus was born. Mm-hmm. How might we know when John the Baptist was born?
Zechariah's third time in the temple.
Exactly. Okay. It would relate to, again, what Luke tells us about Zechariah going into the temple. That's John's father.
Yeah.
And he went in as part of the priestly rota.
Yes.
And I think if I remember, his priestly rota was the order of Abijah.
Mm-hmm.
And all that means nothing to us, because we haven't learnt the Book of Chronicles as thoroughly as we might. But if you go into the Old Testament, you can actually look at the whole rota of the priests, and knowing which order it was, and I think he was the 8th out of 24 or something like that, you can actually pinpoint the time of year when it would be his turn to go in. And then all you have to do is add on 9 months to get to the birth of John the Baptist. Because to be honest, I can't imagine that Zechariah, after that wonderful experience in the temple, hung around and before deciding, oh, I better get on with this. Let's bring this birth to be. So there was no great delay. I'm not saying it was necessarily that night, but...
Well, wouldn't he have had to stay on duty for the approved time?
Well, maybe, which would only be, what, about a week? Something like that?
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was this rota, wasn't there? And probably at most 2 weeks. And you don't know whether it was at the beginning or the end of the... At least I can't remember whether it was beginning or end of that time. But what I'm saying, there wasn't a lengthy delay. So you can add on 9 months to get to the birth of John the Baptist and then another 6 months. And apparently, if you do that, I haven't checked out all the details of it, but it makes sense that you'll end up coming round to somewhere around the Feast of Tabernacles, September, October time. And of course, depending which year it was, which is another mystery, we still don't really know which particular year this happened.
Excuse me, but does that tie in, I don't know, on the road to Emmaus... Did the men say he tabernacled with us?
Don't recall it there, but do you mean when they got to the house and they went in and he broke bread?
Yeah. Okay, so that ties in that he was born at Tabernacles and died at Tabernacles.
Well, it was...
Just look...
No, sorry, he didn't die at Tabernacles.
No.
He died at Passover.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But it was John, in John chapter 1, that talks about... We always read this bit, the Word became flesh and dwelt amongst us. But it's hiding what John is really saying about him literally pitching his tent amongst us, taking on a form that was like the equivalent of the Shekinah glory inside the tabernacle, that he was a new version of the tabernacle. And maybe John was picking up that idea because he knew something about when the birth of Jesus happened. But as I say, during the rest of the Gospels, no one ever sits down and debates when it was. They're even muddled as to where it was, because they know it should have been at Bethlehem, but they still called him Jesus of Nazareth. They still didn't tie him in with his birthplace from that point of view. Nor were they particularly interested in exactly how old he was or which year it was and so on. All those details don't seem to matter greatly to the main gospel story that's being told, which is the Son of God coming to earth, living and dying for us, and so on.
Could I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Going back to Zechariah, because he was made mute, would that not have disqualified him from the rest of the week?
Oh, I see. I've thought about that. So he was mute until the baby was named, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So that's a very good point.
I
bet during that time they didn't want to carry on, or the others wouldn't let him. So or maybe I'm not 100% up on this sort of thing. It was his order that was doing it for that time. And didn't each person only go in actually once?
Mm.
You know, that was his big day.
They drew lots.
Yeah.
So it might have been the only time in his life that he went in.
Yeah, indeed. And then someone else would go in the next, would view to go in the next day anyway. So
depending on lot, it could have been him again.
Well, yeah. But probably not if he was in the state he was in after all that. So.
Well, I wonder if he used that time. He would have been allowed in the synagogue, wouldn't he?
But I suppose so, just because he was mute. I don't think that would be... It's not like an actual physical disfigurement which stopped people doing things and so on. So
I wondered if he would spend the time studying the Torah for the prophecies about what was going to happen to John. And therefore, when Mary landed on them, Mary, Elizabeth, and Zechariah would discuss as best Zechariah could about all prophecies to come.
Yeah. Oh, yes. He could spend his time very usefully, I'm sure. So, as we come towards the end, I'll just sum up with two of the other brief points. But so, was anyone else going to ask a question or make a comment?
I was just going to say that we need to remember that they probably were far more familiar with the Hebrew scriptures than we are with our Bibles.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. But because this great event had just happened to them, they might have been looking in far more detail.
Yeah.
And how much Mary would have known as a young girl. Would have been less than Zechariah knew the priest, I surmise.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me try and bring some final thoughts into all this. Let's make sure we always distinguish between the nativity, as in the actual incarnation, which is obviously biblical, and the festival, which is grown up round it, also, if you like, called the nativity, which is very different. And celebrate the incarnation. And if there's nothing else, it's a time for us to reflect, are we actually living in the way that the incarnation suggests that we should? In other words, God took the trouble, shall I call it that, to send his son. Okay, so we as Christians can be, should we say, more reflective upon that and more determined that for the rest of the year we are going to live incarnationally, that's a word, in other words, indwelt by God himself in our lives. So we can use it, I think, a little bit like the Jews might do Rosh Hashanah, is to set themselves up again for the next year by thinking about the incarnation and what it means for us having God live in us. The problem is not in celebrating Christmas or whether we celebrate it or not, but making sure that whatever we do it well, and we do it in line with what Jesus wants and what God's will is. Yes, the culture and consumerism may dictate our customs, but perhaps we can be more creative and find a new focus. Perhaps by simplifying it, it enables us to sanctify it more. And yes, it is a time for giving. Perhaps it's a time for not buying so much, but for giving more, but without having to spend more in the sense of spend things in the way the world tells us to spend things. Give more away. Use our money to help redeem the festival and the time. And yes, it's a time for giving and spending on our family and our friends, of course, that's all part of it. But apparently, although charities put out a big appeal at this sort of time, don't they? Crisis at Christmas and Salvation Army and so on. And so they can sort of build on that aspect of things. Other charities find this is a very low time of the year because people don't think about other charities. And I suppose the point I'm making out of all this is, as at every time of the year, the use of our money is always a sign of our commitment to God. How we use our money is a very big indicator of the quality of our spiritual life, if you like. So, as always, think about the monetary aspect of it and how you're spending it, how you're giving it, and so on. So if there are some aspects of Christmas that you want to say bah humbug to, fine. But as long as there's some aspects of it you still want to say hallelujah to, and I think that will be some kind of progress or result. So there we are. I feel I've explored that. I know it's not been quite a simple presentation like I normally do. I've been delving around in various notes and things, but I hope you've understood the main things I put up on the PowerPoint and then reflected a little bit more yourself as to what it might mean as individuals as we go through this season again. So should we stop the recording there?
Yep.
And then if people still want to